This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So, Brother Abdullah Al-Andalusi is the department head of the Occidentology Department and co-founder of the Muslim Debate Initiative, an international speaker, thinker, and intellectual activist for Islam and Muslim affairs. His work involves explaining advancing the intellectual proofs for the Islamic belief system, revivalism, and advocating the respecting of the rights of Muslim minorities. He has 13 years of experience engaging in debates with secularists, nationalists, liberals, atheists, and secular Christians, explaining and examining the background and reality behind Western cultural products, philosophies, political systems, values, and intellectual self-justifications. So, assalamu alaikum, Brother Abdullah. Thank you so much for accommodating us with this little up and down we had. And inshallah, I will now make you a co-host so that you may share your screen. And
yep.
Record, inshallah. There we go. Can you?
Sorry, just making sure that, can you hear me okay?
That's fine. Yep, we can hear you. All good.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. As-salatu as-salamu nabi kareem Muhammad wa alayhi al-tayyibin wa sahbihi salihin. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to the attendees, the Diamond Foundation, and the Barakallahu Feekum for inviting me to talk about this extremely important and very serious and tragic situation that's happened to the part of our family of the Ummah of the Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We need to seriously look at and to try our best and to strive through all means prescribed to us by the Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam and in the Quran to alleviate and help our brothers and sisters in undergoing a modern day genocide. In East Turkestan, which some people call Xinjiang province. So to kind of begin, one of the things I feel that whenever we engage in these situations, these topics, there's numerous situations happening around the Muslim world where Muslims are being oppressed, they're having their rights taken away from them, and they're being killed. We have Palestine, we have Kashmir. We've had the occupation of Afghanistan, which is now the obviously Western forces have left Afghanistan. And there was also the Central African Republic. Many Muslims were being killed over there, not so widely publicized, but still tragedies happening to our brothers and sisters nonetheless. And in many other parts in West Africa as well. And the list goes on and on. But China has surpassed these other oppressors in the systematic nature and in the vast scale of the oppression being committed in Xinjiang. And this is something which I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to be able to discharge part of the very big obligation upon all our necks to speak out against. But I don't want to just speak out against it. I want to also discuss with my brothers and sisters the solutions that we can actually implement, regardless of whether these solutions are going to be immediate. It's not like I wish I could just switch a button off and the oppression ends and my brothers and sisters are released from the concentration camps, but that's not obviously something that we can't do. It's beyond the power of any individual Muslim. But therein lies the solution. It is beyond the power of any individual Muslim, yes, but it is not beyond the power of Muslims collectively. And this has always been the case. I feel that 20 years ago, we wouldn't have even imagined such a thing could happen. Mosques just being destroyed blatantly, openly, converted into those that are not destroyed, kept as cultural relics and change into like dancing schools or bars and places for tourists, the Chinese tourists to come in and to basically desecrate with alcohol and not be use it as a house of prayer. So we would never have imagined this 20 years ago. And yet the perpetual or the continuing problem of Muslim disunity has opened up the doors to greater and greater outrages that can be committed against the Muslim Ummah. And I warned many years ago, even before this escalation, that I think it would only get worse over time. It's going to get worse and worse. I mean, just look at Kashmir as one example. I don't want to detract so much from what's happening in the Uyghurs, but I think it's all connected because we are one Ummah, so we're all connected here. The Kashmir, an article of Indian law was revoked, which gave Kashmir an autonomous status, and now it was cut into pieces and now formally annexed into India, and the oppressions only increased upon the Muslims in Kashmir. Prior to that, it was meant to be an unresolved territory that, you know, was still pending UN resolutions, which obviously UN doesn't really do much solutions when it concerns real people who are really being oppressed. But we are seeing now that people are being brazen enough to do things they never thought about before, or they could never do it in public before, against Muslims, and it's only going to get worse. Now, before I kind of discuss the solution, which I think is, you know, from the Quran and Sunnah, which, to be honest, is nothing groundbreaking, radical, or shocking to anyone here. The issue is only our own will to enact that solution, all right? Our own will to see it through and to see how serious this situation is, to use it to motivate us to see it through. So first and foremost, we have to know a bit about the context now. Currently, generally speaking, many Western countries don't usually care about Muslim minorities being oppressed when there's no interest in it. So if they want to cozy up to India as a trading partner, they won't really care so much about the Kashmir issue, only as much as maybe they could leverage it against Pakistan or other countries in the region to serve their own interests. But generally speaking, if their interests are with India, so they don't really care about the Muslims in Kashmir, what's happened to them. But because of a kind of global tussle between China as a rising power and the United States of America, well, now they seem to care. Even Israel, who's conducting many outrages and oppressions against the Palestinians, are condemning China for what it's doing against the Uyghurs. That's because it's now currently in the West and its allies' interests to use the Uyghurs as a bargaining chip against China to attack and demonize China. Not that it needs that much demonizing, the Chinese government, that is. But we have to be careful about being pawns in other people's games, right? And not actually looking out for our own interest as an ummah, having our own interest in heart and not being exploited by others. Now, by all means, we need to go on the platforms offered to us, many non-Muslim platforms, TV programs and others who are now taking more interest in the Uyghurs. We need to obviously, of course, go on these platforms when offered and to speak about the situation that's happening, to in a way increase, ramp up international pressure against China as much as possible. Not that China usually cares about global public pressure. And hence, I would say that while we shouldn't eschew doing those things, we need to also focus on a more long-term solution, because China will not stop what it's doing. It's kind of cultural and even humanitarian, like anti-humanitarian genocide. So they're cleaning out people. They're trying to bring Han Chinese into almost colonialize that country, the territory, and they're also basically trying to change the culture and the religion of the people of that territory at the same time. And if you look at the current kind of predictions, they're going to, in essence, make the Uyghurs a minority in their own country and make them visibly and publicly non-Muslim, ideally, following. I mean, they don't necessarily will force them to follow to become atheists exactly, but as long as they toe the party line and they follow the line of the Communist Party in China, that's what they want, or at least the public profession and loyalty to the Communist Party. So that's the current situation. And I also think that it doesn't, it would not benefit us to approach it from using other Western ideologies. So looking things at like the idea of nationalism. So to say that Uyghurs are an ethno-linguistic group that have a special title to sovereignty in a land against what the Chinese are doing, because Chinese are citing nationalism. Nationalism is a very arbitrary term. Chinese will say that, well, we're all Chinese nationals. You should do what the nation of China, nation state of China demands you to do. And to say that, well, the only way to counter that is to counter it with Uyghur nationalism, is not really from an Islamic basis or perspective. We need to view it from an Islamic lens. An Islamic lens is our brothers and sisters in East Turkestan are being abused and oppressed. And now we need to focus on what does the Quran and Sunnah, what advice can it give us? What not advice, what commands does it give us? So we see that the Rasulullah, I'll start with the verse of Quran first. So the Quran says, and hold firmly to the rope of Allah and do not become divided. And remember the favor of Allah upon you when you were enemies and he brought your hearts together and you became by his favor brothers. And you were on the edge of a pit of the fire and he saved you from it. Thus Allah makes clear to you his verses that you may be guided. And do not be like the ones who became divided and differed after clear proofs had come to them, and those will have a great punishment. Now, we know this verse, but we really don't, as Muslims, fully understand and embrace the real import of that verse. The verse is said, do not become divided amongst yourselves. Muslims often think, many Muslims across the world think, that this just means maybe we're not having difference of opinion with each other. But that's impossible. Right? Even the Sahabas had slight differences of opinion amongst themselves. You can't unite everyone's opinion on being exactly the same outside of the basic aqidah of Islam. In the furu', in the branches of the deen, in fiqh, we're going to have difference of opinion. And that's great, right? Difference of opinion is a mercy. That's not a problem. But if that's the case, then what unity is the Quran referring to here? Okay, I mean, look at the context. It's referring to the Aus and Khazraj, who were fighting each other before Islam. And then when Islam came, they saw each other as brothers, right, and sisters, and they united as one. And they even became called the Ansar, right? The helpers, the those of Medina. And they're no longer the Yathribites or the nation state of Yathrib. It was Medina, just the city, right? Simply the city of Islam and the launch pad of the comprehensive way of life of Islam to the world. So then what is this unity that the Quran is advocating for us to follow? So do not so hold firmly to the rope of Allah, which is obviously the Quran, at which everyone can agree minimally is the Quran, of course, and of course the commands given to us by the Prophet Muhammad and do not become divided, which means we have to be united. But then what remains, what unity is this? The only meaning is political unity. What that means is that we see each other as one, our peace is one, our wars are one. If someone oppresses part of one of us, they oppress all of us, right? If someone hurts a Muslim, it's as if they've hurt all the Muslim Ummah, all of us, okay? You need to look at this as if your own father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter has been taken into a Chinese concentration camp. If you don't view it like that, then I would argue you haven't embraced the spirit of unity, which we see in many ahadith by the Rasulullah. To paraphrase, the ummah is like a body. When part of it is struck with illness, the rest responds with fever and, you know, discomfort, to paraphrase the narration. So we are, in essence, one ummah. But then how do you have political unity? Right? How do you have political unity? What does that mean to have political unity? Well, the Muslims have always understood it for 1,300 years prior to colonialism, which cut us into pieces, is that we were meant to be one ummah with no borders between us and no separate states, and certainly not separate nation states, where from the European idea, and it is a European idea, by the way, of nationalism, whereby they say that each cultural linguistic group deserves to have a state which represents its language and fulfills its particular interests of one particular cultural group against other people, cultural groups, and they have a better entitlement to the land they live on than anyone else. Whereas as Muslims, we know that we are all part of Bani Adam. You can have different languages, that's not a problem. You can have different styles of food. You can have different styles of dress within the Islamic requirements. But that doesn't mean now that you now have a political privilege to have a government that represents your cultural, ethno-linguistic group. When we're not aliens, we're all humans. Our needs are pretty much the same, you know, education, health, water, sanitation, food, jobs, opportunities. These are things that are universal. Why does it matter what ethno-linguistic group you come from? This is a very modern invention, and they use this invention, many of the European colonialists, to cut the Ummah into pieces and get Muslims fighting each other. So now Turks and Kurds fight each other, Persians, Arabs fight each other. Where prior to this, they wouldn't be fighting on ethnic grounds at all whatsoever. So then now, what is the basis for unity of the Muslim world? And I know that many people think when they hear this that, not this same thing again, the same message, but it wouldn't be needed to be repeated if we're not getting the message. And I dare say, I fear it is Allah who's giving us the message by this increasing persecution that's getting worse and worse of the Muslims everywhere in the world, not even just in Kashmir and in Palestine and in East Turkestan, but also in the West now. Like, look what the Muslims of France, look what they're undergoing. Okay, I mean, it's not so, the oppression is increasing, although it's not as blatant in the Anglosphere countries like United States of America and in United Kingdom, with government policies on de-radicalization and counter-extremism, where when they list certain concepts, what is an extremist idea, it would cover most mainstream religions, Abrahamic religions generally. Their core tenets are going to be almost silently deemed to be extreme and by stealth, and no one, we're kind of sleepwalking into that. But I won't get distracted with discussing Muslim minorities in the West. So then what does the Rasulullah SAW command us regarding, well, now to how to practically implement unity, and what does this unity do? We see that the Prophet Muhammad SAW is reported to have said, the imam of the Muslims, it's basically the imam of the Muslims, is a shield behind whom you fight and you protect yourself with. So the Prophet Muhammad SAW was very explicit that the Muslim ummah is meant to have one imam, and just one imam that unites all of us. So a caliph just means a successor to the Prophet Muhammad's role as the political leader of the Muslims, defending the Muslims, uniting our resources together, and being able to use that united political, economic, and military clout to defend the ummah. We all know about the famous incident of the Caliph Muntasim Billah. Was a caliph who, during his reign, the Eastern Romans invaded into Muslim land. They took a Muslim woman hostage, and it was reported that she called out to Muntasim Billah. We don't know if that's true or not, but we do know the response, which is that the Muslim armies crossed the Roman borders and fought the Romans to rescue the Muslim hostages. Right, so Muslim blood meant something. Muslim lives meant something and was willing to be fought for. Right. Whereas now, Muslim blood is cheap. And I would dare say that no one deems it cheaper than Muslims themselves. If you see by many the reactions by Muslims, then they're not taking this as a priority, as a concern that they should be. We know from another hadith that, to paraphrase, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala values the blood of the one drop of blood of the Muslim more than the Kaaba and all its surroundings. Okay. What would the Muslim ummah do if China just came and bombed the Kaaba, destroyed it, and carpet bombed all of Mecca? How would they respond? Well, guess what? The one drop of blood of a single Muslim is worth more to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala than the Kaaba and its surroundings. The Kaaba and its surroundings, it's not living, right? It's bricks and mortar, as they say, right? Stones and bricks and mortar. But we as Muslims, our blood is worth, or just one drop of it is worth more to Allah than the Kaaba and all its surroundings. This is in a hadith, this is in the sunnah. We need to take this seriously. And I can't stress this enough. This is not an academic topic here we're talking about. This is the lives of hundreds of thousands of our brothers and sisters in East Turkestan. Okay, and what's happening to them? I feel reticent to repeat. It's not just they're being killed in these concentration camps, tortured, raped, brutally. And I feel hard to compose myself and bring out the details. So I'll leave it like that to keep myself legible. But it's something which we need to take seriously. Now, here's the thing. When Muslims look at certain Muslim rulers, they say, oh, well, look at Imran Khan. Why is he not talking out about what's happening in East Turkestan? Okay. What's the response generally from even his supporters? You know, what they say, well, what can he do? If Pakistan is weak against China, and Pakistan needs to have an alliance with China to buttress against India, which India has, you know, a larger army. You know, India, you know, is being very belligerent. The only thing that some people say, only thing that might stop India from invading the rest of Kashmir, is the threat of the Chinese army coming in and rescuing their ally, of which they've invested a lot of money in. Some would say bought like they do in many countries. They buy, in essence, they put countries into debt, and then they say, if you can't pay off the debt, no problem, we'll take this port from you. Sri Lanka almost now has become a client state to China, and people are saying the same thing is happening in Pakistan. But what about Turkey as well? While Turkey has raised some issues, it doesn't really approach it seriously, because again, because of the pressure from the West, it needs to find economic allies where it can. Iran too sees, it's a separate weak country, needs to find allies where it can. Certainly under economic sanctions, it's benefited from trade with China. So instead of saying, well, look at these traitors, governments or traitor countries, as I said, most of the Muslim world has business with China. So it's not just those countries, by the way, it's virtually all the Muslim countries. The argument that's always given is they're so weak, they're divided. What can they do? Well, I tell you what it can do, which is we need to reconstitute. And I mean, seriously, reconstitute the Khalifa system or Khilafah system that was taken away in 1924 under the fall of the Ottoman Khilafah. If we don't unite our armies, unite our resources, you're going to see that same excuse mentioned again and again and again. Each individual Muslim country is too weak to do anything, right? If we don't have a kind of mutually supporting economic system where, develop our own industries, build trade links amongst ourselves, stop boycotting each other, stop having these ridiculous wars with each other, killing Muslims, which is an offense you can go to Jahannam for. A Muslim killing a Muslim, you can go to Jahannam for this, right? So these are very big things we need to speak out against. But if we don't work, we don't support organizations, peaceful organizations, which use the prophetic method to give da'wah and you revive the Muslim ummah they speak to the armies, they speak to the civil servants, they speak to the people, they speak to everyone, and they are basically trying to get a critical mass together to begin the reconstitution of the Khilafah, a system we've had for 1300 years, okay? And I'd just like to maybe point out to you that there was a time when the Tang Dynasty of China was expanding into the area now we see as Turkestan. Tibet, the empire, the kingdom of Tibet couldn't limit them so much, but they were a separate, obviously, kingdom from China back then. The one power that could limit the expansion of the Tang Dynasty of China was the Abbasid Khilafah, which defeated them at the Battle of Talas, right, and formed an effective bulwark against their expansion. So much so that Kashgar was actually part of the Abbasid Khilafah. Kashgar, which is now in East Turkestan, it's part of the which is, you think, you know, Muslims don't know, you don't might not know their history so much, might think, whatever part of China, quote unquote, modern day China, was ever under Muslim rule. Well, certainly parts of East Turkestan were under Muslim rule. Kashgar was under Muslim rule. It was under a local emir who gave bayat to the Abbasid Khilafah, the Abbasid Caliphate, right? Muslims defended those lands. if we don't reconstitute, unite our economies together, unite our armies together, and take this seriously, it's just going to get worse for Muslims. Okay, and it needn't be. It's not pie in the sky. Anyway, it really the only thing that stops Muslims from reconstituting the Islamic system, the Khilafah, is just our own will. Really, it really is just that. It's just that we just want. You just have to want to. It's as simple as that, and it's an obligation that is in the Quran that we're not meant to be divided amongst ourselves. There's hadith from the Rasulullah talking about the future, or rather, he was asked about the future by a Sahaba who said, regarding different fitnas that would occur to the Muslim world, different challenges and things. The Prophet Muhammad advised him or told him that stick to the Jama'ah and their Imam, the Jama'ah of the Muslims, the central state of the Muslim. And then the Sahaba said, what if there's no Jama'ah and there's no Imam? It's not just no Imam, but no Jama'ah, basically, like the Muslim. And it doesn't mean no Muslims, because then the Sahaba was asking, what if I'm in that time? Well, he's a Muslim, right? Yeah. So what if there's no Jama'ah, as in the Muslims are no longer united, right? What did the Prophet Muhammad advise? Said that to split off from all the different the different countries, different splinter group states and things. Even if you have to eat the roots of trees, we can't use a nation state system. We can't use these divided states. They don't even have any authority in Islam. Different governments don't actually even have any authority in Islam. Historically speaking, all regional leaders only had authority if they were given official investiture by the Khalifa. The Tawliya, they were made official walis by the Khalifa, by the Imam of the Jama'ah of the Muslims. Right, and this was so important that this lasted until 1922, and then obviously what the Ottomans lost World War One, and obviously the rest we know. So, but did you know that the Ottomans sent fleets to Malaysia and Indonesia to defend them against Portuguese colonialism, right, in the 17th century, right? Even though they were not under direct control of the Ottoman Khilafah, but the Ottoman Caliph viewed it, these are Muslims, this is part of the Jama'ah, he has a responsibility. So, then you might say, even if there wasn't a united Islamic system and state amongst all the Muslims, are you saying that now that would require an invasion of China and to rescue East Turkestan and so on and so forth? I say, not necessarily, but there are many tools that are such a big super state, as some people sometimes like to call it, could do against this situation. One of those things is that, according to various surveys, the biggest route of China's sea routes go through the Malacca Strait, right, which is between Malaysia and Indonesia. There's a very thin strait, right? It's like the Suez Canal of the Eastern Pacific. It's basically a very kind of very thin strait, and the vast majority of Chinese goods go through that very small strait. Guess what? With enough backing, Malaysia and Indonesia, with the rest of the Muslim Ummah, could simply cut it off to China and say, if you don't stop what you're doing, we stop your trade. And then the rest of the Belt and Road Initiative by China goes through Central Asia, right? Kazakhstan. And there's now discussions about Afghanistan. Now China's talking to the Taliban about certain deals, and of course Pakistan as well. There's a belt going part of this Belt and Road Initiative to go through into Gwadar Port, I believe, in the south. What if the Muslim Ummah, as one united voice, and the one Imam said, "You're going to have no more trade through us, China. We're going to cut every single link you can to the rest of the world." And you have to be forced to spend a lot of money going through the Panama Canal, or all the way around Australia, or going through Russia. And obviously, Russia's going to exploit that, and China doesn't like that. So we can cut it off. If you don't stop what you're doing, right? Then this is the first thing we're going to do. Right? Imagine that message sent to China. It's not like China can't invade Malaysia or Indonesia. Can't do that to reopen the straits, right? It's all because it's over water and so on and so forth. But if the Muslim Ummah was united, these are practical steps that would issue very strong economic sanction against China for what it's doing. as a first step, right? And of course, facing a united Muslim world, China wouldn't do it in the first place. They wouldn't have done these things. They wouldn't do what they're doing to the Uyghurs in the first place, faced with a united Muslim world. So what I would say is that, in essence, yes, we must speak out against what's happening against our brothers and sisters in East Turkestan. Yes, we must use every platform we can to denounce what China is doing. But we have to remember that despite all those things that we want to do, and all those condemnations of what India is doing in Kashmir, or what Israel is doing in Palestine, the Israeli state, it hasn't stopped them, right? It doesn't stop them, okay? What does stop them is Muslims showing a united front, an actual politically united front. And you have to remember, brothers and sisters, that even though you were born into a world where everyone just seemed to act quite normally in these separate nation states and what have you, you just think, oh, okay, I mean, what's this obligation of having a khilafah? If it's so important, why is not anyone doing anything about it? We're living in an unnatural situation in Islamic history, in Muslim history. For 1300 years, we had one. It was the only thing that stopped the Crusades. It was the only thing that stopped the Mongols. It was the thing that stopped Tang Dynasty expansion in Turkestan. If you get rid of it, like we have, or was getting rid of for us, you're going to see the situation that we're seeing today, and it's going to get worse. The more they push, and the less resistance they feel pushed back, the more they keep pushing. I've never seen a bully ever be content with the first acquiescence of the victim. I've never ever seen a bully do that. A bully asks for more. So even if you don't care about Allah's obligations, even if you don't care about his commands, which I think is ridiculous, of course, you should, for your own hereafter, at the very least, for your own purpose of life. There's no other meaning of life other than to follow Allah. But even if you're going to be a person who's cynical and only cares about even interest or benefit in this world, at least for the Muslims, generally speaking, then you need to care about bringing back the one defense mechanism that the Prophet Muhammad left behind, that would politically protect and militarily and economically protect the lives, the wealth, the safety of the Muslim Ummah, of the Jama'ah, inshallah. And we need to work steadfast. You need to, any peaceful political group that you see working for it, support them. If there's none in your area, make one and do the da'wah to the Muslim, amongst the Muslims, call them to it. Because remember, the only thing that stops Muslims doing it is just will, the lack of will. If all Muslims, and if you are convinced right now of its importance, if you are convinced right now of its obligation, do you know what the method is? Very simple. Just convince other people to think exactly like you now. Convince other Muslims to think exactly like you now. And that will advance us, getting us closer to that goal, inshallah. And there are many ahadith that talk about a time of oppression. And after that time, a Khilafah Rashida, a rightly guided caliphate on the method of the Prophet Muhammad. It's Muslim and Ahmed bin Hanbal. It's a prophecy of the future. There's going to be Khilafah, and then there's going to be oppressive rule, and then afterwards there's going to be Khilafah again, rightly guided Khilafah on the method of the Prophet Muhammad. So we have a promise of victory. So inshallah, let us put our tawakkul in Allah, put our faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and let follow his commands and solve permanently these problems so that they never raise their ugly head again. Barakallahu feekum for listening.